You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 4th of January, 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we're broadcasting live at RadioAryan.com because we have the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II with us. Dennis, Happy New Year to you. How are you doing today on this first Friday of the new year?
I'm doing okay, Sven. Happy New Year to you as well. All the listeners. I've been working on part 17 because I was determined to at least try and get it out. But the problem has been a couple of technical things, and plus the fact that you don't know whether YouTube's going to knock it off anyway, kind of kills a bit of the drive in you. But I managed to put an effort in today, and it should be up Sunday or Monday.
Is BitChute, is that still up? Will you be able to upload it to BitChute?
Well, I could try, but every time, well, last time I tried, like, you know, just. It went up, but wouldn't play.
Well, there's also archive.org as well. I mean, I was uploading it to as many different places as possible.
That's true. That's a good possibility.
So even if it goes down on one, then it's still available elsewhere.
Still
and
around.
Of course, yeah, once other people have downloaded it, they'll be able to mirror it, and you'll be able to try and build up channels on other platforms as well. But it's good to hear that... You've got a new episode that's going to be...
Yeah, well, it was tough, and, you know, we covered it a while back, but it was tough, and but just one or two things that I had, it just gelled it all together, and now I'm happy with it.
Is this the final episode?
No. There's another one after this. As far as I know, there's only one more, maybe two.
Penultimate episode. Well, we've got quite an in-depth episode to get into tonight of the podcast, actually, and this is basically from an email that was sent to us. This is from someone calling themselves Cleric Preston 3. It's from Australia. They say, in year 11 and 12, it has now become compulsory to study power and authority in the modern world as a core part of their education. Page 65 of the link, and there's a link sent to me, shows what is to be taught, including the Nazi ideology and the regime's impact in Germany on workers, youth, women, religion, culture, and minorities, including Jews. I might soon be tutoring a Christian young men's group, and if you and Dennis could discuss the bullet points of the Nazi regime to 1939, it would help me to instruct these teenage boys in this area of their history curriculum. And this history curriculum is basically taking the place of Holocaust indoctrination. Everyone has to study the Holocaust now, and it looks like this has taken the place of it, and it's more sort of National Socialist bashing rather than concentrating on the gas chambers. I think it's basically trying to say that all nationalists are bad. All nationalists are like these Nazis, and they just want to take over and crush dissent and censor everything. So really, we want to sort of counter that narrative here. Have you got anything to say about that, Dennis, about this stuff that they teach the kids at schools before we begin?
Well, we all know about the Holocaust. That's going to be worldwide, and they're going to use that for every generation coming. Just strengthens their bid to keep people away from nationalism at a young age, if you like. Definitely a good idea to bring some to the front. How long it'll be maintained before they all jump on it, I don't know. But the truth about National Socialism in Germany is very rarely heard.
Well, they're putting a huge, great Holocaust memorial in front of the Houses of Parliament, as if to say, look, everyone has to bow down to this before they enter into the British Parliament. It's quite shocking, really. There's no monument to all the Europeans that died in that war. It's just a huge monument to these Jews that were supposedly gassed. And we're not living in Jew land. It's England.
Well, there's two things I'd like to say. One is that something like that, you know, a big special statue done to it will convince even more people that it's legitimate. The other thing I wanted to mention as well was I heard the other day that there was a court ruling in America which people were putting in demands for reparations for the blacks because of the slavery they went through. And apparently one school or one university has offered free education as part of that reparation thing.
Well, they still have to pass the exams to get in. So I don't know how much the free education will do for them. I don't. They're desperate to try and get blacks into university. Places like Oxford and University, Oxford and Cambridge universities, they're offering free tutoring, free costs of travel, less price on the actual courses themselves, and they've said that they don't have to get score as highly in the entrance exams as well, and they can still only get one or two that actually qualify to be taken on. So I don't know what that will do.
It was more that the fact that they were pushing for reparations got me.
Well, they're constantly doing that, aren't they? Doing that. I like Patrick Little's idea. Yeah, we'll give the blacks compensation for slavery, and we'll take it from Israel for compensation for all the wars. Try and get them on board that way.
Yeah.
Anyway, getting into this education compulsory curriculum that we've got here, the Nazi regime up to 1939. It begins with the rise of the Nazi Party and Hitler in Germany, and the collapse of the Weimar Republic. And I've got a quote here from Wikipedia talking about the hyperinflation, which really did affect them badly at this time. Hyperinflation affected the German Papier Mark, the currency of the Weimar Republic, between 1921 and 1923. It caused considerable internal political instability in the country, the occupation of the Ruhr by France and Belgium, as well as misery for the general populace. In April 1921, the Reparations Commission announced the London Payment Plan, under which Germany would pay reparations in gold or foreign currency in annual instalments of 2 billion gold marks, plus 26% of the value of Germany's exports. This was accepted by Germany after an Allied ultimatum the following month. The first payment was made when it came due in June 1921. It marked the beginning of an increasingly rapid devaluation of the mark, which fell in value to approximately 330 marks per dollar. The total reparations demanded were 132 billion gold marks, but Germany had to pay only 50 billion marks, which was still just as impossible. Since reparations were required to be repaid in hard currency, not the rapidly depreciating paper mark, one strategy that Germany used was the mass printing of banknotes to buy foreign currency, which was then used to pay reparations. That greatly exacerbated the inflation of the paper mark. So before we get to 1932, we've got to look at the 10 years before and the extreme poverty that there was in Germany, where you had people starving on the streets. You had women that were hanging up having to prostitute their daughters. On top of that, Germany had also lost all the territories, lots of territories due to the Versailles Treaty, and the country was in a real state. It was in a state of collapse. There was communist revolutions that were taking place. Berlin had been turned into Sin City, just total depravity, basically. And the Jews had risen in power because of all that depreciation of the money, and they were able to move in from elsewhere in Europe and buy up the farms and buy up the factories. So it ended up with the Jews owning everything, and the Germans were like slaves, basically, and starving on the streets. And that was taking place in the 10 years before the rise of Adolf Hitler. Basically, that's what I would say about it. What have you got to say, Dennis, about the rise of the Nazi Party and the collapse of the Weimar Republic?
I'm going to be honest, it makes a lottery, that statement, was in the secretly built up Hitler to bring Germany down. Germany were already down before he got there. So, at the end of the day, I mean, they've been kicked from pillar to post. I mean, they had the starvation after World War One. They were still having starvation, even in peacetime, as you just said. There's even photographs on the internet of cutting up a horse and taking the meat. I believe they were eating rats as well. You know, people were going through the bins and the rubbish. Just, and to be honest, I mean, you know, the treaties that they were forced to sign because of that original starvation plan, this is one of the reasons they didn't want to sign it. I mean, it was one of them treaties what were meant to destroy Germany.
It was guaranteed to bring about the Second World War, basically. And that was said.
Yeah, if there's any fire left in the Germans, which obviously eventually did have.
And you also got to remember that America was brought into the war by Jews. I mean, Germany and Britain were in a stalemate, and it looked like the war would end. And these international Jews went to Britain and said, if you give us Palestine, we'll bring the Americans in. And the Americans came in, and Germany was forced to capitulate. And at the same time, there were all these strikes going off, and this was all engineered by the Jews. And Germany's Jews were on the side of the international Jews. So they were on the side of America. So they were seen as traitors. So
that was always on about. Yeah.
And that played a big role in it, as well as, you know, the way that the Jews started to corrupt the culture and promote plays about divorce, and they started promoting abortion, and they had Magnus Hirschfeld and his Bureau of Bolshevik Sexism or something like that. And he was basically doing what Alfred Kinsey was doing later on in America, sexology. And he was trying to get rid of the clause that banned sodomy and made that illegal. And he was constantly trying to promote homosexuality and transsexuals and all of this total depravity. And the Germans were disgusted at this. And there was a huge epidemic of syphilis as well, from all the sexual depravity that was going on. So it was in a really bad way. And what they'll try to push, what these schools will try to push, is that Hitler took power by violent means, by coercive means, basically. And that's completely untrue. In 1923, they had their beer hall push, and that ended up with lots of them dying, basically, and it failed, and Hitler was sent to prison. And while he was in prison, he wrote Mein Kampf, and then he decided while he was in prison that they had to win by democratic means. They had to win at the ballot box. And after that, everything was done legitimately. And the Storm Battalion that we keep hearing about, these terrible stormtroopers beating people up. And they were just there to defend the nationalist meetings from the Antifa. That's all they were there for. And they had to, you had to have somebody to defend the meetings, because these violent communists would turn up and they'd be armed and they'd be doing the same as they try to do today, smashing in windows, trying to beat people up, trying to identify who they were, terrorist activities. Yeah. And they wouldn't be arrested. So they had to have a parallel paramilitary force just as security so that they could have their meetings. And this worked. This succeeded.
And outnumbered as well.
Vastly, vastly outnumbered by the communists. Mm-hmm. 6 million communists when he took power, and they ended up winning the communists around. They weren't forced to go along with National Socialism. They saw the rise in living conditions and the rise in wages and the improvements in every walk of life, and they became National Socialists themselves. That basically takes us up to 1932, which is really the start of the legitimate side of it. And on the 31st of July, they had the Reichstag elections, and the National Socialist Workers' Party became the largest party with 13.7 million votes, and they acquired 230 out of 608 seats in the Reichstag. And you know, they weren't holding a gun to people's heads to get them to vote for them.
Well, it actually reminds me of the second part of The Greatest Story Never Told, because I've done the first part, and then I was working on the second part, which was the election stage, when it actually shows, you know, the increasing from 3 seats to 30 seats and up and whatever in the Reichstag. But I remember doing a part two when I weren't happy with it. Didn't sit right. I mean, it wasn't up to standard, and I'm only into part two. So I squashed that, and then I worked on some really, really great music, put it all with Hitler's Rise. It just gelled, just like, you know, like I meant.
Well, it certainly adds to it, the music and the documentary series. I mean, it's the thing, you could just show the documentary series to them, but that would take 6 hours. And
you know, true.
Kids probably got a short concentration
span. Yeah, attention span, yeah.
But that was basically the situation. And, you know, everything had been bought up by these Jews as well. You know, the family farms had been taken over by them. You imagine these farms that have been in the same hands for hundreds of years, and they've just been sold.
That's an old trick, isn't it? They do that over in England with the houses. You know, they get on a mortgage deficit, and the houses were probably worth, you know, 50,000 still to pay on it, and they get it for pennies. And they did it in the American time when the Wall Street crash. See, these crashes are manipulated by the banks.
Totally manipulated. I mean, a lot of what we take for granted today, you know, they wouldn't have stood 4 years ago. I mean, you look at the supermarkets that we have today. You
know, they're true there.
They've done away with everything in the high street. I mean, back then, this was shocking that there were these Jews were moving in and setting up these big malls, these big supermarkets, and all the independent traders were being done out of business. And you know, they weren't standing for it. And today, everything is like that. You know, it's all big supermarkets outside of town. And, you know, the farms have all been taken over, and they've got to produce all their milk for Tesco's, and it's all subsidies from the EU. And what they were trying to do back then was be self-sufficient.
Yeah.
Produce their own. This played in later on when they came out with the bartering system. But I think that gives us an idea of the conditions of Germany and the conditions of Weimar Germany. I mean, they look back at it and they say, oh, well, it was a golden age. Well, it was a golden age for Jews because it was full of depravity.
Perverts.
Yeah, for Jews and perverts, it was a golden age. And drugs were legal back then as well. So you had a lot of drug taking that was going on. Heroin, cocaine,
well, it was all legal. I don't think there was anything what wasn't. Maybe it made paedophilia, but it certainly went on in Berlin.
Well, they probably got close to that. They definitely got close to that with what these sex professors, sex scientists, or whatever they were, what they were investigating. And the Germans just, they didn't want that. That wasn't their tradition. This was Jewish traditions that were being forced upon them. So next we get to the next bullet point is the initial consolidation of Nazi power, 1933 to 1944. And these are, you know, quite a lot happened in those few years there. On the 30th of January, President Hindenburg appoints Hitler the Chancellor of a Nazi DNVP coalition. And then soon after that, we get the Reichstag fire by the communists. And we get told today that this was started by the National Socialists. But it wasn't. They had a trial, the evidence was there, and that it was communists that set fire to the Reichstag. Why would Hitler set fire to, you know, an old architectural marvel that was a part of German heritage? You know, I would think it was the last thing that he'd want to do. What do you know about this Reichstag fire, Dennis?
Well, they've always said, as far as I can recall, that, the National Socialists did it, even though, you know, they arrested a communist and tried him, as you say. But they always failed to mention that the fury amongst the communists at that time, when they won, National Socialists actually won power, this is something that they're going to live with. And there's quite easily 6 million reasons there why that Reichstag should burn down, because they hated the National Socialists so much.
Well, you just have to look at the way they reacted to Donald Trump being elected.
Correct.
It's pretty similar, isn't it? I mean, they're going absolutely wild over it, and these communists went absolutely wild when the National Socialists won. Well, because of this fire, there was the Reichstag fire decree gave Hitler powers which he wouldn't have had before, which meant that he finally had more powers, and he was actually able to make changes. Because of these changes, he then got a lot more success at the ballot box. And this is like with Matteo Salvini. When he was first elected in, he was just about got into power. As soon as he was in, within a few months, he started making massive changes to immigration law, turning back the boats. He's just written off a big law about gypsies and all sorts. And because of that, his popularity has doubled. You know, they've just voted him, I think, the most popular Italian politician in history. He's massively popular. And he hasn't even been in power for a year yet. And that's just because it's a nationalist that's in a position where they can make changes, and they do. Mm. And those changes are exactly what the public want, because they're doing what's best for the people, which is what Hitler was doing. So in the 5th of March, general elections resulted in a majority for the National Socialist Coalition. Although it wasn't a majority for the National Socialists, it was a majority for their coalition. And then on the 24th of March, we got the Enabling Act, which we've talked about before, which was passed with the help of the Catholic Centre Party, which is because the Pope had words with the Catholics, didn't he?
Yeah. That sent them into the National Socialist Party, because they closed down the Centre Party.
Yeah, they ended up closing down the Centre Party because the Pope believed in National Socialism. So all the people that voted for the Catholic Centre Party ended up voting for the National Socialists. And this Enabling Act effectively handed legislative powers of the Reichstag over to the Chancellor. And it permitted the Chancellor and the Cabinet to issue laws without a vote from Parliament, and also to deviate from the Constitution. Which that's what Germany needs to do today, is deviate from the Constitution. Germany can't even deport any foreign criminals at the moment, because their constitution will not allow them to deport anyone to a country that has a death penalty, which is all these countries in the Middle East. So it doesn't matter what the intruders do in Germany, the Germans can't actually get rid of them because of this constitution that's been forced upon them. So you can't think that, you can't sort of think, well, it's like the American Constitution today, and we say, well, we don't want that changed. In Germany, this constitution that they had, it needed to be changed. They needed to say things like, you know, to be German, you have to actually be German. You can't be Jewish and call yourself German. That's they're foreign.
Sounds right to me, though.
Soon after this, the Jews declared war on Germany. And this was international news. It was in all the international papers. And don't forget that, you know, Germany's had all these problems with the economy. Hitler's just got into power. He's just started making his positive changes. And straight away, the Jews, the Jews of the world are saying, right, we're going to boycott all German goods. So Germany responded. And on the 1st of April, they had a one-day boycott of Jewish shops. Just one day, and you think, and the rest of the world is trying to boycott all their goods all together. Can you tell us a bit about that Judea declaring war on Germany, Dennis?
Oh, they didn't really know what to do with Germany at the time, because, you know, Hitler had come to power, and so they had a meeting, a world jury meeting, and the plan was to give Germany an ultimatum to reinstate every Jew and communist, and to get rid of Adolf Hitler. They put that forward to the power in Germany, and obviously they refused. And so Samuel Untermeyer went back to the United States and on radio announced a sacred holy war against Germany. And actually, it went a long way to in the Christians of America and the West to go to Germany to fight the Christians, the Christian Germans who were fighting the communists. It was what one would call a good con job.
He also made conditions worse for the Jews in Germany by doing that.
And one thing else everybody overlooks is that Holy War declaration was never revoked.
Well, yeah, you can see that today. They've never let up, have they? Still going after them. But so basically, when Hitler got those special powers, he must have removed the communists from their office, from where they were.
Yeah. Whether they were Jews or not, communists mostly were.
That's the thing. If you think 90% of the leading communists were Jews, so if you remove the communists, it looks like you're removing all the Jews. And of course, yeah, that's what they'll say.
Obviously, they never say communists, they say Jews, which a lot of people, if they knew they were communists, wouldn't be that bothered.
And just to show the support for all this, the university students went out and burned all the communist books. And it wasn't the National Socialist Party doing it. It was the university students that were sick of being taught all this nonsense, promotion of homosexuality, you know, all the sort of cultural Marxist crap that is promoted today.
That we face today, yeah.
Yeah, was being forced down their throats in the universities, and they didn't want it. So they burned the books. It was students that were doing it. It wasn't an official decree from the government to start burning books. And on the 20th of July, so this is just 6 months in, you get the Reichsconcordat that was signed with the Holy See. So yeah. Then you get the joining together of, well, that's really the start of the Third Reich, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah.
The Holy Reich, which we've talked about quite a lot, haven't we, about
that's right.
This went on. Do you want to talk about it again a little bit, Dennis?
Well, I mean, it basically means church joining state, and that becomes the Third Reich, the Third Empire, and, you know, joining with the other two previously. And I'm quite sure this is what Hitler wanted to establish, because that was the power before World War One, when the Jews, the Freemasons, literally defeated, well, although Russia was on the side of the Freemasons, that was a Christian nation defeated, then the other two were Germany and Austria, Hungary, two great Christian empires. After World War One, the Freemasons really had the upper hand.
And this was finally a turning in the tide against the Jews and against the Freemasons. And then Hitler saw the results of this from the public when they had an election at the end of the year, on the 12th of November, Reichstag elections occur. And the National Socialists acquire 95.2% of the vote. 95% of the vote. So yeah. They didn't steal power and suddenly become a dictatorship. And they were having plebiscites, weren't they, Dennis? And asking the public what they thought and were they doing well? And they were continually getting over 90% every time that the public voted for them.
You know, I think part of that was because they were being educated as well. You know, they were being told about certain things and why certain things had happened in the past, and blatantly obvious to a lot of people, especially them students who were burning the books. So it had a big impact on the population because they were being told what exactly the problem was and, you know, how to prevent it again.
In 1934, in August, there was another plebiscite. And 90% of the people approved the merger of the offices of President and Chancellor. And Hitler assumed the new title of Führer and Reichskanzler, which is leader and Reich Chancellor. So he's now both the head of state as well as the head of the government. So, you know, the public must have really approved of what he did, because they wanted him to be in the position pretty much of a king.
Mm.
So that, you know, he could make laws and they would have to be enacted.
Well, even today, our populations, they're unaware. They think democracy is a wonderful thing, but they're unaware that democracy is just another way of using the public to their advantage, the elite's advantage, just like communism was. And then the usual thing is to move from democracy to socialism and then slip into communism. But people are still unaware of all this. And Hitler explained all this to his speech. Many times he mentioned the evil of democracy and the fact that somebody who had, you know, the good intentions to be a dictator was far better than an elected leader through democracy, which has its ways and means of getting people elected who they want.
Well, you have to take responsibility. If you're a dictator and you're leading in that system, you are responsible for everything. If something goes wrong, you are responsible. If it goes right, you are responsible. You can't say, well, it was, you know, it was the last government that are responsible. It was the
Which
last
is what
government.
They always say.
Yeah, the last government spent all the budget. Oh, it was the last government that did away with the welfare and the benefits for the disabled. Oh, it was the last government that signed that treaty with the EU and opened up the borders. There's none of that.
Don't blame us. Yeah, exactly. When all the time, democracy is such that even though the government's changed from time to time, the actual small things change as well, but the main things never change, which is like a secret dictatorship, if you like.
Yeah, it means that there are people in the background that are actually running things, and we don't know who they are.
Appointed people.
And they're just puppets.
And Churchill was wrong.
Whereas what you've got here is you can see that the changes that he's making have obviously had very, very positive effects for the people. Otherwise, they wouldn't all be voting for them. And they were regularly given the chance to vote. I mean, we were given a referendum on Brexit, and that's the only thing we've ever had in Britain where the public have been asked for their opinion.
Yeah.
You know, Germans were being asked their opinion. Yeah, well, the Germans were asked their opinion on matters of importance just about every year, more often than that even. And the reasons for why they were so popular will come up now. This is the next bullet heading, and it says the nature of Nazi ideology. And I thought, you can look at the ideology, you can say, well, it was based on Christian principles. It was anti-usury. They promoted racial hygiene. They promoted self-improvement, anti-immorality, and they were nationalist. And if you look at every single one of those, they are what would be called today anti-Semitic, because every one of those goes against what the Jews promote. So naturally, they were also anti-Semitic. But we went into the 25 points quite a while back, didn't we, Dennis? And we did four episodes looking at them, and they give a good idea of what the ideology was. And if you look at the first one of these, they were Christian. They promoted positive Christianity. So what that meant was taking out the Jewish corruption that was in the church. That meant that instead of promoting Jewish ideals, the church was to be responsible for uplifting the spirits of the German people. They were responsible for the spiritual side of things, and the National Socialist Party, they were responsible for the state and the political side of things. And the center of Christian teaching is love your neighbor as yourself. That doesn't mean love the Jew. It means love your neighbor. And for the Germans, that meant love your German neighbor. So it meant putting the needs of the nation above the needs of the individual. And it meant encouraging the best out of the Germans. And the brightest kids were given the best education, and the less bright kids were taught to do less demanding tasks. You know, they were given instruction on how to be labourers or how to work on farms. And, you know, they could leave school early and they would have a job there. And the ones that were really bright, they would stay at school, they'd go to, they'd get the best education, and they would be primed to be leaders in the new Germany of tomorrow. Instead of the way that we look at it today, everybody's equal. So that means we've got to raise up those that are absolutely no good whatsoever and not give any encouragement to the ones that are naturally very good. It was the opposite of that. And if you think, 98% of Germany was Christian? Something like that?
Yeah, I've no doubt. I mean, just think about this education system, what we have, the way we do it, like you just emphasised, was the fact that when you're putting these lesser kids in with the real clever ones, the clever ones get held back.
Yeah, you can't raise them up. All it does is drag down the bright ones. And they did. They would send the kids at school as well, the city kids, they would be sent into the rural areas to see how life was on the farms, so that the German people or the next generation understood how important it was outside of the cities, and the people that were responsible for milking the cows and producing the sheep and growing the crops, and that they were just as important as the scientists and the philosophers that were in the cities.
Yeah, that's right.
So it wasn't this idea of there being a class war, which was the communist idea, trying to cause division between the Germans. He was trying to unite the Germans. So it was a Christian philosophy that went right the way through National Socialism, and an anti-Jewish philosophy which
he got rid of the union side as well, didn't he? Because of that, that were all linked to socialist, Marxist, socialist, and the communism. He didn't feel the need for unions. He thought management and workers could sort it out between themselves, which they did.
Yeah, and the unions are always run by the Jews, always run by this outside force. That's why they want the unions so much.
Yeah.
And you had a reforming of the banking system. So instead of paying interest, you weren't paying interest. They got rid of usury. If there was going to be loans, there was some money that was made on the loans, but that money was going back into the nation. It wasn't going to foreign bankers.
Yeah.
They completely changed the banking system, decoupled it from the gold standard, and they just created the amount of money that they needed for their building projects. And when the building project was finished and earning money, that went back into the pot until it was zeroed. Whereas the way of doing it today is that they will borrow the money, that the government will borrow the money from the private banks, and that's the budget, and then they'll tax all the people to pay that back, and then all the interest on top. And what the Germans were doing was just creating what was needed for whatever project, and then, you know, they would work out how much the project would make, how much it would need to get finished, and then it would get zeroed. And when they were doing trade with other nations, they said, well, this has got to be done by barter. So we'll give you X amount of dollars worth of rubber, and you give us X amount of dollars worth of petrol. And we'll cut out the middleman. We'll cut out the international banker in the middle. And this infuriated them.
We should have annoyed the international banker in the middle, no doubt.
Yeah, it infuriated them. But, you know, it was great for the German people.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. And it meant that, you know, there was new roads, there was new infrastructure, new houses were being built. And because they were encouraging Germans to produce more Germans, you would have 25% off the mortgage for each child that you had. So if you had four children, you got a free house.
Not a bad deal.
Yeah, it was perfect. And that ties in with the racial hygiene. So they want, instead of just wanting to improve the individual, they also wanted to improve the race, improve the nation. They wanted the brightest people to be encouraged to produce more bright children. Again, the opposite of today. If you're fairly bright today, then you probably have a good job. And if you've got a good job, you don't get any benefits. It's all means-tested benefits in Britain. Yeah. And you won't get anything if you're married. If you're a single mother, if you split up from your partner and you've got a broken home, then you'll get money from the government. Then they'll give you a house. And it's usually the people in the lowest strata of society that get that help. And in Germany, they said, well, no, because we want the brightest people to get lots of help. We want them to get the help. So the people at the lowest forms of society, they still got help, but also the bright, intelligent ones, they got the most help because that's obviously going to be the best investment. And the people that had genetic problems, such as diseases, or they were drunkards, or they were habitual criminals, they were offered incentives to get sterilized. They were offered incentives to do that. If they were criminals, they'd already forfeited, their right to really be a citizen. But people that had diseases and problems like that, they would say, well, we'll pay you to get sterilized. And if you adopt somebody that doesn't have a disease, we will give you a reward for that, and we'll make you, you know, we'll make everybody aware of what a selfless thing that you've done in doing that. So they raised up the good people in society that adopted rather than producing their own kids with blindness or with Down syndrome or whatever. And by that, they improved the hygiene of the whole nation. And why would you be against that? Why would you want to see more diseased people being born? Why would you want there to be more criminals being born, or more alcoholics, or more junkies? It doesn't make sense.
I had to laugh when somebody left a comment once on one of the YouTube videos after the part where he explained that there was hardly any crime once Hitler came to power, and where families could walk the streets of Berlin safely. And somebody left a comment and said, well, no wonder there was no crime. You were a dictator. Exactly. meaning what's the better system?
Well, there was no crime. Crime rate went right down. Why would people want to be carrying out crimes when there was full employment? This was the other thing. Because of all the infrastructure that was being built, there was jobs for everyone. And the women didn't have to work.
Well, it's true, because over here, there was a case of, in Liverpool, there was some kind of robbery going on of muggings of people, something like that. And the actual, I think it was a conservative woman who was in charge of all this, and she actually said, well, we're just going to have to stop the benefits then. Well, doesn't that mean then lads are going to go around mugging even more?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Not at all.
And they were all about improving, not just mentally, but improving physically as well. So today they're doing away with all the sports fields. They've sold all the kids' sports fields at school. But in National Socialist Germany, they were all out doing exercises every day. It was all encouraged to have a healthy, fit body and a healthy, fit mind, and encouraged to improve themselves. National Socialism was about being the best you can possibly be and doing that for the good of your nation. Not doing it out of selfish desire, but doing it because you want the best for your nation.
If you see any of the clips of them girls exercising, I mean, they're just wonderful clips. They're just natural, beautiful girls who were, you know, haven't got the decadency of the girls we have today in the West.
Oh, it's just wonderful to look at the footage that there is of what life was like in the Third Reich. It was idyllic. And the workers themselves, they had the first Clean Air Act. They had holidays that were paid for. They had cruise ships for them all to go away on that were refused to dock in Britain because the British didn't want the British people to actually see the working conditions of the Germans, because they would have been, you know, there would have been an uprising in Britain if they saw how well the German workers were being treated. And a lot of these laws that they brought in, the rest of the world followed after the war. Benefits and welfare for people and unemployment benefit, that sort of thing. They were the first to bring in animal welfare laws to prevent the ill treatment of animals. And the worst that could happen to you if you were a troublemaker is that you would go to one of these camps and you would be taught the value of work. They wanted to reform people. They would send them to these camps and teach them how to work. And teach them the benefit of an honest day's work, which is what the Jews hated, being forced to work rather than being bankers. They couldn't cope with this. The Jews absolutely hated it, and they did away with all the pornography, all the prostitution, all the sex museums and the sex universities. All of that was done away with. They got rid of the syphilis problem that they had. They were very anti-immorality. Kids could go out on the streets again without seeing the filth and the decadence that was there during the Weimar period. So these were all things that they encouraged people to do. Yeah, very, very high morals that they had. And this was their ideology. And the ideology was anti-Jewish. And what it meant by anti-Jewish was that it was anti-usury, it was anti-pornography, it was anti-degeneracy, anti-homosexuality, you know, anti all these immoral things that the Jews take great pleasure in promoting. And that's not anti-Semitic to say, they do. All the pornography companies are run by Jews, all the banks are run by Jews, Hollywood is run by Jews. They do take great pleasure in corrupting people. And the Germans Hitler didn't want the Germans to be corrupted. And also, why would you want foreigners to be running your government for you? You wouldn't want to have foreigners in your government. So foreigners weren't allowed to be citizens. They could be guests if they didn't cause any trouble. They could be guests. And there were plenty of Jews that didn't go to the camps. There were Jews that fought in the German army. Half Jews, but they couldn't actually be citizens. And again, the world's Jews hated this. This is like a great sin to them that they were banned from actually taking part in civil life in Germany. But why should they have a right to the civil life of Germany when they're not German? It goes against all common sense, the system that we have today, where we can have people that aren't anything to do with us, aren't anything to do with our bloodline, are ruling us. And not just in the government, but as a part of the EU. How are they ever going to be doing what's best for you if they're part of another race?
Well, a prime example of that is they didn't exactly ask people to vote, did they want all these migrants? And they've admitted the migrants now. I mean, at first they were trying to convince us all the refugees. But, you know, on the admittance of these migrants, they're like, there's still no ballot on it. Well, this has got to be.
Well, yeah, a Jew or a Negro that was in government, I mean, they'd be stupid not to be doing what's best for their own people, to be doing what's best for us instead of what's best for them, and they never will do. It's only our crazy people that have believed all this propaganda and think we should be doing what's best for the world instead of doing what's best for us. And if an individual was to do that, they'd end up starving to death if they didn't take care of their own needs first. And that's the way you have to look at it. You know, the nation is just like another individual. It's just an individual that's made up of lots of individuals that share the same family. You have to put your family first. You know, I do find it strange the way that the Jews get so angry at this time because they were expelled from taking part in government. You know, and it happens wherever throughout history where they've been expelled from somewhere or not allowed to take part in civic life, and they seem to think they should have this right to rule over other people, basically, which is what it is.
No, it comes from the chosen people thing, doesn't it?
Well, I think it says in the Bible that you should never let a foreigner rule over you. Never let a foreigner rule over you. That's a curse, basically. That means that your nation's been cursed by a foreigner ruling over you. Well, that's the bullet point there on the ideology. The next one is the role of prominent individuals in the Nazi state. So maybe you want to take some of these a little bit more, Dennis. Tell us about the role of Himmler, the SS chief.
Well, Himmler, there's been a lot said about him, but he was in charge of the SS, another organisation which was well educated on why things had happened to Germany and how to prevent them. And he was a Catholic at one point, but he actually fell out with the clerical side of the Vatican and didn't actually become a pagan, as people think. He just became his own Catholic, if you like, but not with any church leaning, whatever they wanted to say to him. And that kind of gives then credence to people calling him a pagan, and he was into all this mysticism and Kabbalah, which is garbage. He was still a Christian, come from a strong Christian family, and led the SS in a Christian noble way.
And they were based on the Teutonic Knights, the Christian order. Weren't they? They were supposed to be the knights of tomorrow, the new aristocracy of tomorrow. They were supposed to be noble people that were taught to have the best manners and the best courtesy
and
the brightest people. And, you know, they're totally demonized and slandered today. And they can't possibly have been anything like what they say today, because they were supposed to be the best that Germany had to offer. The very best people. And he was the head
of it. Yeah, I think if you want to learn about them, I think it's Leon de Grel, who goes into great detail about how they used to even smarten up before they even went into a town. You know, they made sure that they were all dressed impeccably. Even though they were just, you know, they were going in, not fight or anything like that, but just going in and giving this image of impeccability.
Striving for excellence. I mean, that began with the Hitler Youth as well, before you even get to the SS. It's constant striving for excellence and lots of investment in the youth, because they were the future of the nation. Again, something today we just take all the heritage away from the youth. We mortgage their future and say we'll pay back all these debts to the banks, and our children will have to pay for all of that, and our children will have to pay for all the increased prices on the houses. And they never would have entertained doing anything like that back in Germany. Everything was being done for the next generation. They saw themselves as a link in a chain. Rather than, well, you have all these rights, it was, well, you have all these duties. All these people that came before you provided all of this, so your duty is to improve on it for what you hand to the next generation. And the Jewish way of doing things is, well, everything that's there is for me to take. And it doesn't matter about the next generation. Everyone, every man for himself. You know, that's the root of human rights. That's the roots of the Jewish ideology. And that's because they come into, as outsiders, into somebody else's nation. And they've managed to con us into thinking every man for himself is the way that we need to be. Make as much profit as you can. Not, well, actually, that's just taking from myself, because these people are part of my family. I don't want to be making as much profit from my own family. I want them to succeed as well, not just myself. Everything is about selfishness. There's no such way.
A person in communism by the back door where I demonstrated with this rabbi was telling people the difference between a Jew and a Gentile or a goy. And one of the ways was when he said, you know, a bucket of water, when you empty the bucket of water, the water, what you're emptying is the Jew, and the two drops in the bottom of the bucket is the Gentile. So this way of thought, you know, when they do go into these other countries, they are superior in every way, and so look at them in an inferior way. And needless to say, that then carries on with, you know, they don't care what happens to them.
That's the contempt that they have for us. Mm. Another one of the prominent individuals, that was Goebbels. Do you want to tell us a bit about Goebbels, Dennis?
Yeah, Goebbels is another one. He sometimes, you know, he gets picked on because of this myth of all the Germans have to be blonde-haired, 6 foot and athletes. And he actually had a club foot, but he made away any physical deficiency with a superior mind. And in fact, his speeches were really high level, you know, equaling or challenging some of Hitler's at times. So he was an intelligent guy, a good organizer, and he was a guy who they sent to Berlin at a time when they were far outnumbered. I think there was like 200,000 communists in Berlin, and he went just from there with a handful of National Socialists and managed to turn things around and clean it up.
They were all extremely intelligent. He was a fantastic propagandist. Mm-hmm. Well, next one that I've got here is Rudolf Hess. Can you tell us a bit about Rudolf Hess, the Deputy Führer?
Yeah, well, Rudolf Hess, second in command, actually. He idolised Adolf Hitler. I mean, he said right at the end of the Nuremberg trials, when the day comes when I'm going to meet the Maker, I'm quite convinced that he will believe that I was right, and you know, he wouldn't suffer at all. I mean, you know, he was so convinced that Adolf Hitler, what he was doing, was right, and that he was indeed sent from Providence. And, you know, this trip over to England to try and sort out, I believe anyway, you know, a peace treaty before, you know, the war with the Russians started, because that was going to happen at any moment. And if they could secure this peace with Britain, then all the better. But obviously he was locked up by Churchill, put in the Tower of London, and wasn't seen again for many years.
Absolutely selfless act, that, flying over to Britain, trying to broker a peace treaty to prevent there being any more war. And he was treated absolutely abominably, being sent to prison for the rest of his life for crimes against peace, when he was the only man trying to actually make peace.
Stop the war, yeah.
Incredible.
And well, he never got to tell his story, because obviously, you know, on the day he was going to be free, not on the day, but he knew the day where he was going to be free, meet his family again, but yet committed suicide before then, or so they claim. But did they really want him telling the truth once he got out? I'm not so sure.
Oh, they completely wanted him silenced. They didn't want him ever speaking to the public, I think.
No.
Kept him locked up in Spandau prison all on his own. Solitary prisoner. Right. for the rest of his life. Horrific treatment for such a good man, a real noble hero, Rudolf Hess was. Well, what about Hermann Göring? Do you know much about Hermann Göring, Dennis?
Well, besides the fact that he was quite flamboyant, it was World War One, a war hero in the Air Force, was in charge of the Air Force and the Gestapo, and often criticised. But, you know, I mean, the Battle of Britain was a half-hearted attempt. They thought maybe they could quell things with the Air Force, but wasn't to be, and then he switched over to the Russian invasion. But, I mean, at the Nuremberg trials, it showed what kind of guy he was. I mean, this is coming from an American there, and he said you could tell you stood in his company, you could tell that he had this commanding presence, and a lot of people were in awe of him. And at one point, even the Nuremberg trials were going his way.
They were all 100% alpha males.
Yeah.
Exactly what you want leading your country and in your government, the very best of the best people. And even when you think of Hitler and the awards that he won in the First World War and the job that he had, absolutely, running to the front with messages, which is a job that he volunteered for, one of the most dangerous ones, but also one of the most important ones. So you got very, very brave people of very high intelligence that, you know, take an incredible risks on behalf of their nation because they love their nation. So, you know, very, very hard push to actually find any bad guys in, actually among the National Socialists themselves. But of course, Hollywood will tell you that they're all, you know, the devil themselves. But once you look into it, you see that, well, no, they're not. The next, bullet point that we've got here is the various methods used by the Nazi regime to exercise control, including laws, censorship, repression, terror, propaganda, and cult of personality. And I think, well, basically, their methods were no different to any methods that governments use today.
I was going to say that, yeah.
Yeah, they use the police, they use the courts, the justice system. I don't think they locked people up for criticizing their policies. I mean, they locked up communists. I don't think they did what the British government does today and locks people up for putting stickers up for 6 years and accuses people of being terrorists. I mean, the communists were actual terrorists. They had stockpiles full of weapons and they went out and blew up train stations and blew up railways and, you know, they went out and killed people. They weren't people that were just criticising the policy of the National Socialists. So, you know, I don't really know what they're trying to push about how the Nazi regime was any different to governments today. If you've got a government that's in power, they're making the laws.
Mm-hmm.
And it says terror here. The German people certainly weren't terrified. They fought right down to the last old man and the last child to keep Germany from the communists.
Yeah.
They weren't terrorized. They, you know, they worshipped Adolf Hitler because of what he'd done for their people. Propaganda. Well, yes, you know, Goebbels was a great propagandist, but look at the propaganda of today.
Hollywood.
Everything promotes the same idea. Everything promotes anti-racism. It promotes anti-sexism, anti-homophobia, Islamophilia, judophilia. Yeah. You know, everything does. It's full.
I mean,
full
every
spectrum.
Christmas you have a couple. Though there's always one's always a black guy, and one's always a white woman. Every time when you get these Christmas adverts, just emphasise again, you know, what they're trying to push subconsciously on people.
Yeah, there's no difference. They're just a lot better at it today, I would suggest. I mean, back then you had Germany, which was promoting National Socialism, but outside of Germany, the rest of the white world, they weren't promoting National Socialism. So you still had their information that was available. And if you look at the way things are today, that they're trying to ban everything on the internet. So you can't see any alternative view whatsoever.
Yeah, shadow banning.
Yeah, the Germans weren't banning any information coming in from outside. They weren't doing that at all. They were trying to get their information out to the rest of the world.
And that would be blocked. That was the problem.
Yeah, that was being blocked. So, they weren't blocking everybody else. It was them themselves that were being blocked. And it says cult of personality. But if you've got somebody that does such wonderful things for the country, you're going to think that guy is fantastic. You're going to want to wave placards of them. We see it today with Bashar al-Assad. And we saw it in Libya with Gaddafi when people were waving placards of them. And they weren't waving placards for Adolf Hitler in Germany, but they were saluting and masses of crowds. I mean, that's genuine. You can see
it. I found some real footage, some unknown footage, when I did the Great Story, I told the crowds, as soon as they saw the car, they just absolutely flooded. I don't know where I got it from. It was poor quality, but I managed to increase the quality on it as well. It was just amazing to watch.
Yeah, you have got some amazing footage in that. Well, I'm so enjoying this. We've flashed through today's episode, Dennis.
We've
still got one heading to go. Yeah. We've got one heading to go, which is the impact of the Nazi regime on life in Germany, including cultural expression, religion, and workers. And I think we'll do that next week.
Yeah,
because sure. Probably get a whole episode out of that. So thank you very much for coming on today, Dennis.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next Friday with more Truth Without Radio for you. And of course, we do wish you all a very happy New Year.